Since the early ages, the sanest of people have seen and felt things that defy explanation. Things that stay with them for the rest of their lives. To unburden themselves of these tales, they turn to author and researcher Steph Young, collating innumerable stories of darkness, of phenomena that march to a different drum. The Parade of Mysteries. The Dark Parade. Turn off your lights, close your eyes, and see for yourself. The Dark Parade with Steph Young.
So I came across a story that someone had put on the internet several years ago about what she said happened to her when she was at a campground in Montauk, New York State. It happened in 1971, when Michelle Guerin was a teenager, and she went missing from Ditch Plains Campground. She says, "During a visit to my uncle's campsite at Ditch Plains in Montauk, I was missing for 2 to 3 hours, and my uncle remembers it. It happened in 1971. Years later, in 2003, she began to write about what happened to her, after she underwent hypnosis with a doctor called Dr. Kudrell. This was in an attempt to recover more of her memories about it. She recalls her arrival at the campsite. She says, "We arrive and I change into my bathing suit." Then she puts her shorts on top of her bathing suit. She says, "It's boring, so I'm going to look around. I walk off, and after a while, I pass a group of surfers camping there. One of them looks familiar. It's F," and she uses an abbreviation rather than the person's actual name. "So F, it's F's brother. He asks me if I've seen F yet. He says that he's surfing, so I decide to walk down to look for him in the water. I spot him, and when he heads in, he calls my name. He asks me if I want to take a walk later, and can I meet him back at the campsite. So later, I'm at the campsite with him and we start walking. We walk about a mile and then we walk into the dunes to find a quiet spot. There's a cliff and tall grass there. We sit down on his towel and we start making out. We're laying down. But suddenly, I hear a loud buzzing, like lots of bees. We sit up. What is this? Something's not right. We should run away. I try to yell, but I can't talk. I can't move. I want my mum. It sounds like a car is coming and then stops. The buzzing is louder. A man in a soldier's uniform is looking down at me. Another soldier kicks F. He says, "He's out of it." There are two others with them. They pick me up. They carry F like firemen. We're in a jeep. We're going through some grass. There's a hill up ahead. The hill is moving. It looks like there's a door in the hill. It moves. We drive inside. Other men in black berets are inside. F is held by two men, and two take me. We go through a door into a bright hallway, and turn right at another hallway, and another. F is still going straight, but we stop at an elevator. Inside, we're going down, and then the door opens, and it's much darker down there. There's a smell, like a cesspool, and it's so cold. There's a door, and one of the soldiers opens it. The room is so dark I can hardly see. It looks like there's a padded table. They lay me down on it, then leave the room. I can't seem to move anything but my eyes. Where am I? Why am I here? I don't like this. Over to my left, something moves. It's coming closer. I can see it better. Oh my God, it's a monster. She says, note, at this point, I got so agitated, I was almost jumping off the chair in the doctor's office. I couldn't stop crying and shaking, and I had to be calmed down before I could continue this. What I see is a creature about 6 to 7 feet tall. His ears are large and pointed. His eyes are bright yellow. They glow. It has pointed teeth. He has a tail. He's coming towards me. I've never been so scared in my life. He comes to the foot of the table. He pulls off my bathing suit. His face is so close to mine, I hear raspy sounds. He puts something inside me and I feel like I'm being ripped apart. He likes to see how terrified I am of him. It gives him a lot of pleasure. When he is done, he goes back to the part of the room I first saw him in. They come in and they help me from the room. I'm taken to another, well-lit room. There are machines I don't recognize. There's a table covered in white, and lots of stainless steel equipment. I'm strapped down on the table. People come in wearing white masks and gowns. I feel a prick in my arm. She says that she remembers nothing after that, until she comes around, back at the beach in the dunes. And F is beside her. She says that she also had recall of a dark, cloaked figure. I do not recall any facial features since it was obscured by a hood. But I recall an interrogation by some very human-looking men in military attire. I was asked questions about what I call the little men, the greys. One of their questions was, who or what are they? And I replied to them, they are us. After this session, I was stymied. This was not something that I believed. And if there was a relationship, I've yet to connect the dots. I do not know why the beings I recalled did not appear to have souls. Well, Michelle, of course, wonders, did she fabricate all of this? Did she just imagine this and dream it? She says, I can certainly understand people questioning this. I still find myself questioning if it happened or if I fabricated it all. And it was this skepticism that made me look further into it, forcing me to seek as much validation as I could. Is it suspicious or simply unfortunate coincidence that when scheduled to speak about her experience in November 1991, she suffered a stroke 2 days before she was due to speak? She's had other flashbacks, including seeing a face of a person and a conversation that seemed to be telepathic, of him calling her little one and attempting to soothe her. She says, I recall being in a dark place, afraid, floating in something that felt heavier than water. I had been standing naked in front of a metal door, struggling with a soldier with a machine gun, while a doctor told me I had to do it. I was pleading with him not to make me go in there. I'm afraid of drowning. I want to get out. Why do I have to be in here? I calm myself enough to float. I can feel wires attached to me. I stretch out my arms, trying to feel the walls that enclose me. Are my eyes open? Blackness, floating motion. I can see movement, shadows and forms. Dark grey now. Don't be afraid, little one. Take my hand and I will guide you. Grey turns to blue like the sky. White clouds. It feels like I'm flying. I see tranquil blue water, a beautiful lush hill, mountainous areas, deep canyons, a big white building. Diving through the foam, the white foam of a deep blue wave, I'm underwater. I can see a dark entrance to a cave among the rocks and hills. This is a desolate place. I feel lonely, cold. Time is not what we think it is. Each moment is happening now. An endless loop that we can enter at any point, but we should take care not to disrupt the loops. Well, on the eastern tip of Long Island, New York State, lies the isolated, desolate stretch of land that's now owned by the New York State Office and Parks. It's what remains of the former military base, and there's a huge radar dish, abandoned outbuildings and bunkers. This is Montauk. When it lay abandoned, it was a ripe place for urban explorers, although many found it a creepy place to venture into, as well as risky, in terms of safety and the possibility of getting caught for trespassing. It's not the overground remains of buildings that most intrigue, it's what lies underneath. One of the most widely held beliefs is that the former Air Force base comprises of facilities under the ground, amid the elaborate network of subterranean tunnels, and some believe it is still operational beneath the ground, and that it is home to a top-secret, nefarious Black Ops project of experiments. Some parts of the camp apparently remain closed, and some say that they're guarded. Well, especially the areas near the old satellite and military installations. Richard Whelan, Vice President of the East Hampton Trails Preservation Society and a military history buff, interviewed by Sugar Harbor Press, said that he has explored Camp Hero in depth over the years, before, in fact, it was legal to do so, as well as afterwards. Well, he says there is nothing behind it. There's no mystery here. To the people who live here, this is all just about selling books. Interestingly, though, the deeds to Camp Hero state that although the above ground belongs to the Office of Parks and Recreation, everything below ground belongs to the government. Those termed conspiracy researchers think there is a lot more to Camp Hero than a local historian says. Most notably, there were also some witnesses that would disagree with this version of the story of Camp Hero. They say that they were underground, and the circumstances of them being underground were far from pleasant. Camp Hero, or Montauk, is an alleged place of child abductions, psychological warfare, experiments of torture, mind control, time travel, interdimensional travel, reptilians and greys, and a beast that cannot be defined. What are we to make of all of this? If we go back to Michelle's experience of being abducted near her uncle's campsite and allegedly taken underground, where she was placed in a room with a monster, well, Dr. Helmut Lammer, PhD, wrote My Lab's Military Mind Control and Alien Abduction in 2000, and he attempts to dissect her experience underground at Montauk. He says, we don't think that the military worked with this reptoid creature. It could be possible that she was drugged with an hallucinogen, raped by a human, and projected the reptoid as a kind of screen memory. Although she described the skin and other features of the creature quite realistically. Well, this doctor goes on to say that researcher Dr. Stanislav Grof wrote that the strange alien worlds LSD subjects discover and explore seem to have a reality of their own. They appear to exist in other dimensions or in universes coexistent with ours. The drugged individuals on the hallucinogens can encounter entities who have bizarre physical forms. He gives the example of one female of his LSD subjects who had a sense of identification with a species of large reptiles. And while experiencing this, she opened her eyes and looked at the therapist, who seemed transformed into a reptile. She was fascinated by scales that she visualized on the side of the therapist's head. Well, some have phobias about reptiles. So Helmut, the researcher, says it would be logical that they would experience such beings if they were on a drug trip. From these LSD experiments, then, it should be clear that Michelle's reptoid rape experience could have been drug-induced, where she possibly saw a human transformed into a reptoid, like some of Dr. Groff's test subjects. After the attack on her, Michelle was escorted to an examination room and strapped down. After this examination, she was forced into an isolation tank where she began to hallucinate, Declassified documents show that the intelligence agencies had great interest in this research, says Helmut, and used hallucinogens for cover stories to discredit individuals during these covert operations. So he says, we believe that her experiences show there is evidence she was a victim of such deprivation experiments. If the abductee underwent hypnoprogramming by military psychiatrists, it should have been possible to create these imaginary alien encounters. He goes further. A research project by Dr. Alvin Lawson and Dr. W.C. McCall led to a scientifically testable hypothesis that at least some alien abduction experiences are birth memories, prenatal or birth memories. But this was mostly ridiculed by ET proponents. Well, in an attempt to evaluate alien abductee claims, they induced imaginary abduction experiences in 16 volunteers who had demonstrated no prior significant knowledge of UFOs. Data from 4 imaginary and 4 real abduction cases apparently showed no substantive differences. Also, patterns of events echoing well-established details from real alien abduction encounters emerged from these imaginary sessions. All of the described incidents were identical with those in actual alien abductions, from the disc-like crafts to fetal humanoids to tunnels of light to bonding with an alien to passing through solid walls. So these researchers said that they found that these are especially similar to birth memory narratives of those experiments conducted with drugs by Stanislav Grof. In the birth memory study, he describes different types of non-human beings, from fetal to animal to robot to exotic creature to apparitional, and that these types apparently come close to the reported alien beings. So, they were saying, this is the reason why people without knowledge of reported alien entities report similar entities to abductees. One test subject described, he has sort of scaly-like skin, I'm not comfortable, and the other scaly ones, they just seem to be sort of non-existent or guard-type things or something. So they say this imaginary abductee reported reptoid non-human beings on board an imaginary UFO. And this test subject was just as frightened as the real abductees, such as Michelle. Well, what is very interesting also to note is that this research doctor, having conducted these experiments and had these unexpected results, was very surprised to find that although his research results were published in a very obscure and little read journal, he said that he immediately began to receive literally hundreds of requests for more detailed information from military research centers worldwide. He says interested military intelligence psychologists should therefore be aware of the reported similarities between drug-induced hallucinations and alien abduction experiences spanning since the 1960s. And adds, we can see from this imaginary alien abduction study that it would be easy for psychiatrists who work for secret military or intelligence agencies to create alien abduction scenarios that appear similar to real abduction scenarios. The researcher also attempted to discover if isolation tanks, such as the one Michelle described, being placed into water, really could exist. And what he discovered was that there was an inventor called Dr. John Lilly, and he tried to find out how he could isolate the brain from the mind. He found such a tank inside a soundproof chamber in an isolated building near the campus of the National Institute of Health. Well, this tank had been constructed during Second World War for experiments by the Office of Naval Research into underwater swimming. Well, this was the beginning for research on isolation, including with the use of drugs. But it should be noted that Lily was contacted by covert intelligence services for the Department of Defense. As the isolation tank research became known, various individuals from government agencies called him to find out about it. And Lily claims that among them were researchers working in brainwashing. And they asked him if an isolation tank could be used to change belief systems of persons under coercion. They wanted to use the tanks for experiments in mind control and brainwashing. This doctor visualized that people's belief systems could be changed to the directions desired by the controlling persons. And he was convinced that military intelligence would indeed use this isolation technique for covert experiments. So Michelle's experiences, do they show us that this was what happened to her? Is she one of the victims of such an isolation deprivation tank experiment, being put in water, trying to separate her mind from her brain? If so, then I guess what they're saying is that this creature or the monster that she saw in that room, in the dark room when she was put in there on her own, could actually have been a human that attacked her, and that she'd been given drugs and had hallucinated that it was a reptilian. On the other hand, of course, it doesn't rule out the possibility that there was this creature or monster. Who's to say that the creature didn't exist? Well, 3 years prior to Michelle's report becoming known, a special report was written by a man called John Quinn. He was a researcher and he ran what was called NewsHawk. And this was an email-based news service. And he published a volume number 25 in the Phoenix Journal in October 99. In this he wrote, "A man now living in Calgary named John Tucker has had substantial recall of personal involvement in the Montauk Project. So perhaps this will add more fuel to what Michelle says happened to her." Well, Quinn wrote that John Tucker believes he was a participant during the Montauk Project operations of the late 1970s and early 1980s, and this was while in an altered state of mind or in some alternate parallel reality or timeline. Well, John Tucker says he was a very different person there, and when he was working, he was working on advanced time technologies at Camp Hero. That is, that he literally may have been subjected to some kind of age regression and or transfer of consciousness. During this period, he was called Daniel John Waters, and he has reported on some very strange goings-on in Calgary too, which sounds similar to the information about Denver, with Denver, according to Quinn, being the centre for the New World Order. So Quinn writes, "Given that Calgary is in roughly the same geographical relationship to the Continental Divide as is Denver, perhaps there is some esoteric Earth-energy relationship which may make Calgary suitable for use as another New World Order nerve centre." Quinn continues that this man informed me that one base, although decommissioned and closed, and he says, here we go again, is in fact still functioning, but has become extremely secretive. "This is based," he says, "on observation and eyewitness testimony from a guard who'd been employed there." So Quinn says, just recently, this guard, a close friend of Tucker, and who has worked with him on some research. Well, I question, do security guards often work with physicists helping them with their research? Well, anyway, so I guess I'm questioning this, but unless Quinn means that Tucker and the researcher helped looking into uncovering what was going on, as opposed to actual physics research. Anyway, he says that this security guard was suddenly transferred away from the area without explanation. There were more notable weirdnesses. Now, bearing in mind that this report by Quinn was written in 99, so almost 2 decades ago. Well, Quinn says that some of this weirdness is that this man Tucker told me what was going on there, and he said that these so-called phone transmitter towers appearing everywhere are involved. There is some kind of covert purpose in this. And Quinn says that such transmitters, according to Tuca, are being used for mind control and mind modification of the population. Most towers are operating at much more power than is needed for just cell phone transmission. And Quinn adds, my home is in a very sparsely populated mountain region, but sure enough, a transmitter was installed on the mountain. He says, I was told that Denver is literally crawling with Montauk boys, and to an extent, Montauk girls. These are young people with Aryan characteristics who have been programmed with Montauk, Monarch, techniques in order to be sleeper agents who are to be utilized in psychotic, satanic, barbarous and murderous covert government operations. Well, bizarrely, Tuca also said that the streets of Calgary in 1999 have become inundated with a tremendous number of street people, i.e. homeless, and the great majority of whom fit the requirements for the typical Montauk boys, to a T. Well, at Al Bielik, Preston Nichols and Stuart Swerdlow's well-known and very vivid accounts of their time as Montauk boys and the Project Montauk, absolutely believable. That really is for the reader or listener to decide by looking in their books. But Quinn's report continues, large portions of the Long Island Montauk have underground facilities, including, of course, the Brookhaven Labs, confirmed to the Long Island reporter Jerry Samisi by a private contractor who apparently worked often at the facility there. Well, John Tuca appears to have been posting on the internet since the time that Quinn wrote this report back in 1999, revealing himself as a Montauk witness. And there was a post he made in 2002 to John Titor. Well, John Titor was a person who'd come forward a few years ago to say that he was posting messages on the internet from the future. He was saying that he was a time traveller. So Tuca was replying to John Titor and saying to him, so you're a traveller too? Have you ever interacted with any of the pre-1983 staff at Montauk? If so, you may have met me when I was working there. I was a research and development assistant to Dr. Von Neumann, and I was known as Daniel John Waters. I had a rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the Psi Corps. Well, around the year 2000, John Titor had come forward and shared a diagram of his C204 time machine on the internet. Self-titled hoax hunter, researcher John Rasmus, well, he believes that John Tuca is a person connected with time travel, but outside of the John Titor story. Tuca, who says he was formerly known as Daniel John Waters, apparently helped Stephen Gibbs build the HDR units that became known in the 80s. Stephen Gibbs created the hyper-dimensional resonator in 1985, and this was a device that, according to Gibbs, had the ability to send people physically through time. Well, John Rasmus, the hoax hunter, says Tuca is clearly not sane, but then few HDR users are. Tuca posts his personal home address constantly on websites which are full of time travel links and stories of him being a Montauk boy. These websites actually are no longer online, but for a while there was much speculation on the forums on the internet as to whether Tuca was in fact actually John Titor, although John Titor, time traveller from the future, again could be a hoax. Well, in fact, John Titor seems to have returned quite recently, but that's another story and quite possibly another hoax. Well, looking for more evidence, then, of what may have happened at Montauk. Well, if we focus on John Tuca of Montauk, then, he is saying that he's a time traveller. He's saying that he was working at Montauk. Well, he says that the Montauk Project moved to Robins Air Force Base in Warner Robins in 1995. He says, I moved from Tucson to Warner Robins in 1994 and I graduated from high school there in 1998. Warner Robins is a small town and many people there know me as John. I was working in the high strain rate lab at Georgia Tech. I had independently continued my cosmology research. If my work leads to free energy, but a spy came to look at what I was working on. Well, Tucker says, I solved the major understanding problem in physics. I was also very involved in the Occupy Atlanta movement, and I believe it is partially for these political reasons that I was having strife with the local DHS agents, and that I am not being given due credit for what is evidently my research. So basically he's saying that he has made groundbreaking research in time travel and research in physics in the present day. So he's known as somebody else in the present day, but he's saying that his timeline fits with when he was studying at Georgia Tech and the project at Montauk had moved to Georgia. It's all very confusing. And that in the present day, he claims that many times researchers had taken his research and plagiarized it and not credited him to his groundbreaking efforts. And yet on some forums, many people just say that he's insane. Well, I'm not very good at physics, so I literally could not work out whether he knows anything or not, but that's quite a tale. He says, here's the first paper I wrote. It's highly technical, but it's not mathematical. It's very short. If you have some familiarity with physics, I hope it's understandable. He says, I believe I wrote this on the timeline that both Titors visited in 2009 with a divergence of 1.941. I'm not sure what that means. He also adds, strangely, I looked exactly like Jack Parsons. Well, Jack Parsons was the propulsion engineer and probably a genius, but he was a Thelemite as well, apparently. And some say that he'd been experimenting with trying to open a portal to let entities into our world. Well, Tuca says that he discovered he'd been a Montauk boy through recovered memories and psychical research. He says, but I have no hard evidence that this other person, this other me, existed. And that's why he said he was trying to contact people like John Titor. But he says, by the way, this isn't my original timeline, as I believe that I jumped timelines not long after doing some work with Steve Gibbs on his trip up to Calgary. Well, a skeptical person responds on the forum that he posted all of this. So, while you're working on your PhD, you were part of the Montauk Project, Steve Gibbs' HDR project, you were working with Al Bielik, Dr. von Neumann, and you held the rank of Lieutenant Colonel working on the Psi Corps, under a different name. And you wonder why your professors didn't take your physics theories seriously. Well, presumably no relation, but interestingly, there happened to be a Liam Wallace Tuker who lived on Long Island, home of Montauk. This Tuker is best known for his translations of Indian place names and his study of the first known inhabitants of Montauk, the Aboriginal Montauquette, a place name which the colonialists conferred upon the tribal Indians there, and meaning Fort Place. Well, looking for more evidence of the potential existence of the Montauk Project at Long Island, I came across a lady called Jolene Jojo Seabatcher. Now, she says that she was at Montauk. There's a couple of interviews on the internet that I've heard her speaking about, so you could find her if you look up her name. Well, she says that she is a survivor of satanic ritual abuse, medical experimentation, and black ops military mind control and programming. She says that her abuse began while still in the womb, when her fetus was injected multiple times. On James Bartley's radio show, she says, I was enhanced in my mother's womb. When I was born, I was enhanced further. I was given thousands of injections in my early years and medicated through these injections and taken to my father's business, which she names as a pharmaceutical company. She says that he'd worked for this company on the food services side, where some of the Project Paperclip scientists were working, and which later became Brookhaven Labs. So during my childhood there, I underwent terrible torture, terrible trauma, and then testing in that order. Torture, trauma, testing. Torture, trauma, testing. My siblings got other treatment while I was delivered to their private classes and literally tortured. I was thrown in rooms, waterboarded, frozen, sweated out, horribly sexually abused, and then tested. I've tried throughout my entire childhood into my teenage years, and this is hard for me to talk about, but I've tried to tell any adult that I could of the horrible torture that was happening to me. My memories have always been real. I've carried them with me. I went to many adults for help, but it was declined. The adults I'd gone to for help were part of the paedophile ring and organisation. There were a lot of wealthy people involved, and teachers and doctors. My gymnastics coach. I'd been programmed to do some remote viewing and spy work in my later years, but they trained me so that they sort of overtrained me, and I got to a point where I could trick my programmers and handlers. What made me triumph over it is the type of psychic abilities that I've had ever since I was very young. I vividly remember I could hear people's thoughts, I could hear their feelings, and I could hear this other little voice that I called the soul, or the spirit. I was a good spy. I could tell if people were lying. I could understand secrets and lies in the interrogation process. How it worked was very ugly. I won't go into details because it was ugly. I had a handler into my 20s, but I always had this tendency to sort of trick them toward the latter part of my 30s when I worked for them. The remote viewing I did for the super soldiers, the physical super soldiers, not the type that are on the truth media circuit. I did remote viewing for the real Navy SEALs and Marines, those real supermen that are trained in their physical bodies. I was their ears, their eyes, and their minds on their missions, so they would have an identifiable target. The sexual abuse was a part of it, and the satanic ritual abuse. They do need to use satanic ritual abuse in these programs and projects, especially in the time travel area. In this, I had a different handler, and this side of it I very rarely talk about. I don't want to expose it, because too much could put my life in danger. My handler is a very famous person, and I don't want to talk about the time travel part of my career, if that's okay. There was an aspect of something called, around the time, the Montauk Boys. Well, there was something called the Plum Island Girls. Montauk is not far from the alleged animal hybridization factory and exotic disease creations at Plum Island, a bio-research facility, she says. I'm not going to speak a lot about it, but there is where a lot of the ritual satanic abuse was that I witnessed, not only witnessed, but was made to participate in while I was strapped down to these chairs. With the ritual abuse, the black magic that is imbued for these time portals or gates or expansions, anything, needed to have black magic and serious satanic ritual abuse. A lot of brutality. I have a very, very difficult time talking about my experiences. As a young child into my teenage years, I was very quiet and very shy, and we moved from town to town, going from adult to adult and finding out that they were all part of the same rings, that no matter what hometown my father took us to, he was still with the pharmaceuticals company, but no matter who I went to for help, they were all part of the ring and identifiable to one another. I was married at 17 to my first handler and went to California. I was taken over again for programming. There was NSA involvement, some Hollywood producers involved, a lot of black magic ritual involved, demonic things going on, and these parties. And there was a lot of missing time when I was in California. I experienced my lab things. I refuse to talk about that. I will only talk about that privately. Well, she says that she has tried writing several books about this all, but that each manuscript has been stolen from her home during separate break-ins. She says she managed to break free in her adult life to work through her alters, and she became a world-class Shaolin martial artist, and now dedicates herself to helping others who may have survived similar experiences. While Jolene was recruited for experimentation because her father was employed at the laboratories, the researcher John Quinn, that we mentioned wrote the article back in 1999, disclosed that he had knowledge of Vandenberg AFB in Santa Barbara County, allegedly being named as a site for MKUltra activity. And in a section of his report on the current state of the Project Montauk and related activities, entitled Phoenix Undead, it lists some known subterranean facilities where evidence shows covert PSYOPs activity being conducted. It refers, for example, to an installation beneath Plattsburgh AFB in northeastern New York State as a vast 18-level subterranean facility. Is his research correct? Was Michelle's abduction experience really the way it happened? And what about Jolene Seabetter's awful, awful experiences that she talks about? They all sound like a sci-fi script. Or maybe they were drug-induced hallucinations. But was there really a monster in the underground in Montauk? Along with these terrible experiments? Well, probably completely unrelated, but in Suffolk County, where Montauk is located, Long Island Press published a study in 2005, and they called it The Long Island Missing Children, in which it says most children reported missing end up at home again within days, but a tragic few remain lost for weeks, months, years. A Suffolk County legislative report in 2011 wrote, "The legislature hereby finds and determines that over 2,000 children go missing in the United States each day. This legislature also finds that failure to report a child missing within 24 hours should be a criminal act subject to significant penalties. Violation of this shall constitute a misdemeanor punishable by a fine of up to $1,000 and up to a year's imprisonment." Well, the New York Times reported that from 1984 to 1992, according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, nationwide, nearly 31,000 children were reported missing. Of course, of those, more than 20,000 were returned safely home. But 9,000 remain still missing. Well, of course, we can't necessarily correlate this with anything at all to do with Montauk and these alleged underground bases. And maybe these are people with really active imaginations. But it's strange how there are quite a few accounts like this. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. There are more episodes on Patreon under Steph Young Masquerade Podcast, or you can check out my website, which is Steph Young Author, for some of the books that these stories come from. Thank you.